This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by Flare, a leader in providing actionable cyber threat intelligence to companies and governments around the world.
Today on Intelligence Matters, my co-host Michael Morrell and I are at Yale's Jackson School of Global Affairs, talking to students about a wide range of national security issues. Our host is Ted Wittenstein, Executive Director, International Security Studies. We'll be right back from Yale. But first, here's my colleague, Michael Morrell, with a message about Flare.
The lines between geopolitical risk and cyber risk are blurring. Flare is a next-generation, continuous threat exposure management SaaS platform that equips corporate information security teams with world-class collection and continuous monitoring across dark web cybercrime forums, markets, Telegram channels, and sources of geopolitical risk. Flare sets up in 30 minutes, creates actionable intelligence from hour one, and is used by governments, security teams, and threat intelligence teams around the world. You can try Flare's free trial at their website, flare.io. That's flare.io.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to International Security Studies at the Yale Jackson School of Global Affairs. I'm Ted Wittenstein. We're delighted to host Michael Morrell and Andrew Macritas for an open session of their Intelligence Matters podcast. So I'll just ask a question maybe to get started for what I'm sure will be an interactive exchange. But it's rare to have two intelligence briefers, former briefers to the president, with us here. So I might ask you both to assume that role for just a moment. So if you were in the Oval Office this evening, given the array of threats confronting the United States, the critical role of intelligence in informing national security decision making, how would you brief? Tell us what you might suggest as the top three items that you'd want to make sure were on the president's radar, on the agenda, key questions on your mind. And Michael, maybe we'll start with you. Thank you so much for being here at Yale.
Ted, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. It's a real honor to be back. It's a real honor for me that Andy agreed to become my co-host on Intelligence Matters. I'm absolutely thrilled with that. Steve Dorsey, our technical producer, is here. We could not do this without him. So thank you, Steve. But it's great to be with you all. Ted, that's a tough question. I think I'll answer it from the perspective of being a private citizen rather than the DNI or the director of CIA. I think what I would say is, number one, Mr. President, as you know better than anybody, you know, we live in a world that is, from a national security perspective, is more complex and challenging than really at any time since World War II. Bob Gates wrote about that not long ago in Foreign Affairs, and he's absolutely right. So that's point number one. Point number two is that you can't manage that world without first-rate intelligence, and the key aspect to the intelligence picture is really understanding the intentions of our adversaries. Understanding capabilities is a pretty easy thing. Understanding leadership intentions is much, much more difficult and really requires exquisite human intelligence and exquisite technical intelligence. And you know, you should demand that, and you should resource the intelligence community to be able to produce that kind of intelligence. Third, I would say managing that world is simply not possible without U.S. leadership. Simply not possible without U.S. leadership. And that's not possible without ending the political divide here at home. And you have a special responsibility in that regard, given that you're the president, to do everything you can to end the divisiveness in America. So those are the three points I would make to him.
Thank you, Michael, for that. I have a lot of follow-ups, but I really want to hear Andy's reactions as well.
Thanks, Ted, and thanks for having us. I guess I would answer, you know, in a similar way as Michael did. You know, I would also say to him that, you know, that you need top-rate intelligence, and one of the strengths of the U.S. intelligence community and democracy in general is our partners, and our, in particular, our foreign partners. This is not a go-it-alone kind of situation. You know, we need to be able to rely on our foreign partners to sort of help us and help us understand the world. And the key word that Michael used, you know, complex, and I know it gets thrown around quite a bit, but if you actually look at the definition of complexity, it fits really well with the world today, which sort of suggests that you got a bunch of variables and each one follows local rules that can lead to nonlinearity. And that's really what, you know, we're sort of seeing in the world today, sort of a nonlinear features. And the best defense against those is a intelligence community that's out in front, can warn you, as long as you're willing to listen.
Thank you both. I was struck that both of you emphasized the complexity of global challenges in your comments. And just because both of you have had leadership of the intelligence community and leadership of the CIA, give us a sense of how you think of managing these challenges. Do you view these as isolated challenges requiring focused questions? Do you view the world kind of coalescing where these challenges are connected to each other under a broader frame of geopolitical global competition? How do those three areas look from the perspective of a leader atop the CIA, given the complexity issue that you just emphasized?
So I think, you know, on the first order, you know, you're looking at each one individually in some regards, what's required, what do I need to be able to do in a given situation? But I think the moment you step back, even just a little bit, you then begin to see the connections and the connections that can have an impact in other places, oftentimes in unexpected ways. And so I think that's the, you know, that's one of the roles that as a, you know, director of Central Intelligence or heading any intelligence community organization, you're there to sort of prevent or highlight what could be surprises. What, you know, what could come up that people aren't anticipating? And at least, you know, being able to at least look at those things and understand if they're likely, not likely, you know, what could happen. So I think it's, in each situation is different, but that's the key for being a good intelligence officer, being able to sort of see around the corners and to see down multiple layers.
I would just add a couple things. One is there is something that ties all of them together, right? And it's that China, Russia, and Iran are all revisionist, right? They want to return to a world of the past, right, where they were dominant in a region or globally, and so there's a commonality there. And then you have the fact that they're all working together. They're all working together to undermine U.S. power, undermine U.S. influence, undermine the kind of rules-based order that we put in place after World War II. So they're all tied together that way.
Thank you. We have one interesting question here that was submitted about the global disinformation landscape, and I think it's related to what you were just saying, Michael, about this sort of increasing coordination or shared strategic outlook among Russia, China, and Iran, and that those are primarily the global adversaries, although not exclusively, but primarily the ones that are seeking to influence U.S. and their own domestic population, public opinion, you know, in very aggressive ways. How do you think about managing some of these challenges in the current digital age, disinformation being one of them, but this role of maybe trying to be more open and more forthright about the actions of adversaries as opposed to just informing national security leaders privately?
So I'll start with this one, but I'll quickly turn it over to Andy because he's actually thought a lot about this, in particular how it relates to AI. You know, I think it's safe to say that the information space is a new domain of warfare, both low-level warfare, you know, like we have with the Iranians, and a, you know, high-level warfare like we're seeing between Russia and Ukraine. It is like any other domain, whether that's land, air, sea, space, cyber, right? It is a new domain where people are fighting. And I think the fundamental responsibility of the intelligence community is to learn what the adversary is doing, what their capabilities are with regard to the use of information warfare, what they're actually doing and what they're planning to do, and so that policymakers have information to be able to deal with that. I think strategic downgrades, or you know what we used to call intelligence disclosures, are a legitimate policy tool in that space. I think the tougher question for the U.S. is to what degree are we going to play in this information space? You know, I'll tell you, disinformation is not the best place to play because actually the use of accurate information is much more effective in this. But to what extent are we going to play in places like Russia, China, and Iran? Because at the end of the day, the thing that those leaders are most concerned about are their own people, right? And if you can get them to question whether their own people are with them, then they might change their behavior a bit. But yeah, that's, I'm not sure we've settled on what our policy is on that.
So thanks, Michael. So, you know, what Michael just said about, you know, disclosures is exactly right. And it's a natural friction point between, you know, policymakers and intelligence organizations, probably from the dawn of intelligence organizations, right? You collect information, now how do you use it? You know, where does it go? How can someone use it to benefit, you know, the country? So that's always going to be a pull and tug. Exceedingly effective right before the Russia-Ukraine conflict started, right? So it does, you know, sort of show you that done judiciously and done in the right way, it can have a, you know, a pretty outsized effect. But that friction is always going to be there, where intelligence organizations are going to be cautious about, you know, what is it that they're willing to let be released. When there's an imminent danger like that one, you know, that's one situation. If it's a, you know, something that's moving at a relatively slow pace, what point are you going to risk sources and methods to reveal information? So that's a interesting balance point. This other issue about disinformation and the information space, I couldn't agree more. It's a domain, just like land, sea, air, just as Michael said. And if, you know, if you take a look in Chinese military writings, they've begun talking about cognitive warfare in pretty real terms and what that actually means. And if you read what they're suggesting, and then you sort of take a look at certainly the U.S., we're vulnerable. The PRC is talking about using cognitive warfare to begin to influence our views and opinions. One of the words that they use when they talk about Taiwan is reunification, as if they were a country already, right? And they, you know, they keep saying that, and pretty soon people say, oh, yeah, it's just reunification, right? Which, well, it's not really just that. So it's an interesting area, and it's a place where we're, I think, you know, open societies can be vulnerable.
I'm going to ask you one question about 9/11 that was submitted. We did get a number of submitted questions about sort of lessons learned at the CIA in the aftermath of 9/11. Both of you really played critical roles in reforming and refocusing the intelligence and national security apparatus in really a two-decade effort to sort of combat violent Islamic extremism worldwide. And as you look back on that now, and particularly in light of this complex landscape that you already described for us now, you know, what are some of the key lessons learned from that 20-year campaign in your mind?
So my experience, the, you know, sort of post 9/11, yeah, it was a briefer. You know, Michael was the briefer on 9/11, and then I was a briefer at that time right after 9/11, and then into Afghanistan, Iraq, no WMD in Iraq, that whole thing. And you know what happened during that time period is I think the agency grew analytically. You know, when I first started as an analyst, if you'd ask someone, how do you do analysis? It would be like, well, it's on the job training. You just sort of figure it out as you go along. Not a great answer, you know, overall. But in the intervening years since then, there's been and I know we talked about this in my class, there's a new rigor on how you actually do analysis, how you look at alternatives, what are other possibilities. You know, there's this expression that got used by a professor, his name is Phil Tetlock, about a fox and the hedgehog. And that's basically that, you know, the fox knows many tricks, the hedgehog knows one good one. And sometimes, and basically he was talking about experts. Experts are hedgehogs, you know, foxes are generalists. And his point there was you need to have that mix if you're really going to be able to figure out what's going on. And so the agency has really, I think, on the analytic front, moved much more in that direction of having a more structured, rigorous way to do the analysis, telling policymakers, here's what we know, here's what we don't know, here are the key factors that could change our assessment, things that we just didn't really do in a routine way before. So, you know, I think one of the biggest changes is the kind of analysis that we present to policymakers and making sure that they understand, you know, we're not a crystal ball. And we did have a former Deputy Secretary of State say, look, what I want from you is I don't want you to tell me, I don't want a prediction. I want you to sort of tell me what the envelope is in which I'm operating. And then let me do what I do, what I need to do as a policymaker.
You know, if I was going to make a couple of points, it would be one, a repeat of the second point I made in response to Ted's first question. You have to have exquisite intelligence to stop a terrorist attack. You have to be inside the terrorist organization. Right? You have to know what they're planning and plotting. Strategic warning is not enough. The warnings we provided in the spring and summer about spectacular attack, multiple simultaneous attacks coming, right? There was no reference to time, place, or method. They didn't allow for policy action. You know, for policy action to take place, you need to have some specificity on the threat. We did not have that prior to 9/11. We had that in spades after 9/11. And after 9/11, it was stopping plot after plot, attack after attack, because we had that kind of specific intelligence. It takes an enormous effort. It takes an enormous amount of ingenuity to get inside an organization like that, creativity. So that's a major lesson learned, and it applies to our main adversaries today. You know, do we really understand Xi's thinking about Taiwan? I doubt it. You know, do we really understand Iranian thinking with regard to pursuit of a weapon of mass destruction? I doubt it. Right, we're making analytic assumptions about those two things. We probably don't really know. So that is the critical lesson. A second one that applies to terrorism is safe haven is everything. When a terrorist group has safe haven, they have room to plot and plan and train in a way that they can't when they don't have safe haven. When they have to worry about their security, they're much less effective. You know, we learned that. I think another lesson we learned is, you know, Dave Petraeus told me once that when he was commander in Iraq, that he had a sign put up in every unit in Iraq, and the sign said, is the operation you're about ready to do going to take more bad guys off the battlefield than it puts on? Right? I don't think we spent anywhere enough time thinking about what radicalizes people in the first place, right? And how do we work as a government with other governments to prevent radicalization, right? We were so focused on stopping the next attack that we didn't spend that precious time and resources, right, to think about the underlying problem. We were dealing with a symptom, which is probably why we probably have more extremists on the planet today than we did on September 10th, 2001.
We have a number of questions about future threats, and people want to know what keeps you gentlemen up at night. So we have a few questions about strategic surprise. And history tells us that despite the best intelligence, that there are events that might happen in the world beyond our control. So I'm not asking you to predict necessarily the future strategic surprise, but what are areas that you think about in the world that maybe are not receiving sufficient attention that we haven't yet touched on?
So it's easy to sometimes get caught up with, how's that goes? It's, you know, 8-year-old soccer, where sort of everyone runs to the ball. And that's not just 8-year-olds, it can be the intelligence community and others. So look, the pacing threat today, as we all look at it, is, you know, China and the threat that the PRC poses. So that's certainly on everybody's mind. But if you take a look, you know, more broadly, the things that I guess I get more concerned about are the smaller or unexpected things that can have a outsized impact. If you looked at, you know, a year ago, a small group called the Houthis, you wouldn't think much about the Houthis and what they could do to affect the world. You look at them now and you're like, well, they're sitting in a very strategic place. They can affect shipping and that can affect all of us. And it's really not it's not a potent military force. It's not a big nation. It's none of that. And so I guess I spend time thinking about like what else like that could there be? Things that can create a discontinuity that you don't anticipate. Well, you know, the big threats, but what are these other smaller threats that have an outsized impact? I mean, look, you know, COVID is a really interesting one where you wouldn't necessarily think at first blush that a disease could be a national security challenge. Well, it turned out it was. What's the next thing? Is there a technological surprise, or is there something like this that we're not paying attention to? Because usually the things we're paying attention to we're ready for in one way or another. It's those, that never even dawned on me, which is the challenge for the intelligence community, because the policymakers assume in many cases that you're paying attention to all those things, right?
I'll take a slightly different angle here. I agree with everything Andy said, and I don't have anything to add to it. So I'll take a different angle. So the intelligence community at any moment in time, right, has a whole set of judgments about a whole set of issues. Some percentage of those are wrong. Some percentage of those judgments are wrong. And I'm wondering which of the judgments today are wrong. And, you know, if you think about Iraq WMD, wrong. If you think about our judgment 20 years ago that a richer China would mean a more liberal China engaged more in the world in a positive way, wrong. So I think it would be very helpful to do some sort of exercise, right, in the intelligence community to kind of challenge themselves to say, where are we wrong today? Because there's no doubt that we're wrong about a number of things, right? Just by basic math. So where might be we wrong? Why? Just to go through that whole kind of exercise, I think would be really healthy.
So let's open it up to all of you.
Hello, my name is Valentina, and I'm a student in the college. What keeps me up at night is probably the possibility of China invading Taiwan. And I know that Xi has said that he wants to be prepared to do that by 2027. I'm wondering if you can cite any red lines that you think the United States might pass that would result in the invasion of Taiwan by China.
When he told his military to be ready by 2027, he was admitting that he's not ready today. And that's ready in the context of his willingness to take risk, right? An attempt to invade Taiwan that fails would certainly cost him his job and probably be the end of the Communist Party. So very low risk tolerance. But he basically admitting he's not ready. I think it's safe to say that Xi, you know, we don't know, right? Xi probably views military action as a last resort. What he wants is to coerce Taiwan into the fold. He wants Taiwan to wake up someday and look across the strait and see this massive military, Chinese military, and say, you know, we have to come to some sort of arrangement here. And he wants the U.S. to come to that same conclusion. However, having said that, I think he would act if he had to. And what are those things that would get him to act? You know, one is Taiwan declaring independence, without a doubt. Whether it would involve a full invasion or not, I don't know, since he doesn't think they're ready. It might be some sort of a blockade situation. But there's two other things I think that could lead him to believe he needs to act. One would be the U.S. changing its one China policy. He might feel he needs to make a statement, maybe grab one of the Taiwan islands near China and say, hey, I'm serious about this Taiwan thing. You know, the other might be a formal end to our ambiguity with regard to defending Taiwan. I think if we came out and said, you know, we will absolutely defend Taiwan under any circumstance, it might get him to act, right? To test that statement, grab an island again. Okay, what are you going to do about it? Sort of thing. So I think there are things that we can do that would put Taiwan at risk.
One of the things that strikes me internally that could push this is a collapse of the Chinese economy. If it really took a nosedive, that's the number one concern of Xi and the PRC. And so, you know, if there was economic dislocation and on a big scale, you know, we've seen this happen before. Wars are a convenient way to, you know, move people's attention elsewhere.
To add to that, you know, there's a growing community. It's still a minority, but a growing community of China scholars who believe that China's rise relative to the United States is peaking. And it's not growing, it's peaking, because China's slowed down significantly. It's got significant problems across a range of issues, but that doesn't make them less threatening. It potentially makes them more threatening in the medium term, right? If you think that you are rising relative to the United States and the West, your conclusion is, I have all the time in the world to deal with the Taiwan problem. If you think your time is short in terms of your power relative to the United States, you might conclude you need to act sooner rather than later.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
Hi, Nelson Donegan, Psychology Department. And given the collaboration between Iran, Russia, and China, and dealing with analysis and strategy development, if they decide to coordinate simultaneous crises, then what are the challenges for analysis, given that we're dealing with highly nonlinear dynamic systems? What is going to be the critical role of having an effective AI in analyzing real-time information from the development to aid in developing appropriate responses?
When Michael and I were analysts, we probably felt that we could get through the critical information on the accounts we each covered sometime within the first few hours of the morning as it came in. Right? Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Today, there's no way that an analyst, no matter how good they are, how smart they are, graduated from Yale, is going to be able to get through and make sense of all the stuff that's coming in. So in order to deal with this nonlinear world that you described and these effects that are difficult to predict, I think that where things have to go, and they're starting to trend in that direction, is that as an analyst, I need a co-pilot, for lack of a better expression. I need something or someone that's reliable, that can get through all the information and at least show me where to look. No one's going to replace the human brain anytime soon. We have a Mount Everest amount of information. If we use the methods we used in the past, you would take Mount Everest and whittle it down to the Rocky Mountains. There's no way. And that's every day. There's no way you're going to get through that. So training an AI co-pilot that can actually help you pick up patterns, find these little connections that, you know, may not be obvious or are buried somewhere. So I think that's the future, and that's how we're going to deal with this complexity that both Michael and I talked about at the beginning, and these sort of nonlinear events is training AI, not turning the reins over, let me be clear, but making sure you have a competent AI co-pilot that can help you find those kind of things.
Thank you both for your time. My name is Griffin. I'm a student at the college. I was very interested that all the discussion of the analytical rigor in the past 20 years. I was interested in the fact that we have perhaps incomplete knowledge at the highest levels of decision-making, the Iranian leadership, Xi and so on. But it also seems like in many of these conflict points, it's the sentiment and the swings of the whole population that can make a big difference as well. It was There were difficulties understanding perhaps the way that things would pan out in Afghanistan, the willingness to fight in Ukraine, the potential for willingness to fight in Taiwan. And it seems like that's even more difficult now with the war with Israel and Hamas, especially with a population that really is not available for the usual inferential statistics in Gaza. So I would be interested if you could speak to how one approaches analysis of a population that's really not necessarily available for the usual techniques. How can we be ready to see who they'll side with, what they could or could not support?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think one of the positives today of the technology revolution is now we have tools to actually get at this sentiment in a way that we never did before. Right? I mean, there was always polling, but can you really do polling in North Korea or Iran, right? That's reliable, let alone even do it. But now there's tools, right, to get at people's sentiment without them even know you're asking the question, right? Marketers use it all the time, right, to get at sentiment of consumers. And I think a lot of those same tools can be applied. And, you know, I don't know what goes on at the agency anymore. I don't have visibility into that. I hope they're using those tools to understand, right, what people are thinking and how it's changing, because you're absolutely right. It really matters.
Thank you both for being here. My name's Alex. Mr. McCreadys, from your point earlier on COVID-19, I worked a little bit on the COVID-19 response prior to grad school, and I would like to know, what's the intelligence community's role now in that area, as well as are we more prepared today to deal with that type of threat than we were 2 or 3 years ago?
So I don't know if I can answer the national, are we prepared? You know, that's a big question. But I think the intelligence community certainly looks at the potential for pandemics creating sort of significant national security threats. It sounds foolish to sort of say that and not having thought it before. It was always in the background, and we talked about it for a number of years, but there really wasn't any particular focus on it. COVID changed that because we saw all the dislocations that it created. And so there is a renewed focus across the intelligence community on, you know, disease outbreak. And not just to be able to predict where disease, you know, there's plenty of organizations that can do that, you know, CDC and others, but it's, you know, what effect does it have? And what does the spread of disease mean? And sort of this idea of looking at almost bioradars kind of approach to looking at what's going on in the world, because we are so interconnected that a disease outbreak, even in the furthest corner of the world, could be here in no time, right? So that's clearly a threat, and we just need to understand what that is. So I think the community broadly is better prepared than it was. Are we, you know, 100% prepared? And is the government ready to handle the next crisis? That's a big question I can't answer. But certainly I think we're better off than we were in, the beginning of 2020.
Good evening, gentlemen. My name's Tim Gallagher. I'm the Marine Corps fellow here. Earlier, you referenced the fox and the hedgehog description when you organize an agency or military branch, et cetera. You need to have a certain amount of expertise and a certain amount of generalists. Given the fact that you both briefed the president and rose to the highest ranks of the CIA, how did you prepare yourselves personally to become generalists? What habits of daily habits, weekly habits, monthly habits did you instill early in your career to become that kind of generalist?
I don't think we did anything. I think we had people do stuff to us. We were lucky enough to be asked to do jobs that broadened us. So, you know, Andy was the executive assistant to the deputy director. I was the executive assistant to the director. We were both presidential briefers. I ran the PDB staff. You did some task forces that were broad in scope with regard to the business of CIA. And these are things that people asked us to do, I think in part because they believed it would broaden us and make us better officers. I think we had to be willing to go along with that, right? And what that meant was not just looking at the next rung on the ladder, right, and looking at the next job up, but being open to these broadening assignments. And I had to be pushed a little bit in that direction, probably Andy less so because he's smarter than I am. But I think that's a really important lesson in any organization, is don't just look up the ladder, look across the ladders. You'll end up in more interesting jobs, and you'll end up in jobs that broaden you and make you more competitive for senior assignments.
I think that's the key point. I had a supervisor tell me one day, you know you've arrived when you become the solution to everybody else's problem. And so being willing to say yes when someone approaches you with that, even though you're like, I've had several instances where I've been in a really good job and I had no intention of leaving it at that moment. And then something came up and someone asked me to go do this. And if you're willing to say yes to those kind of things, it comes with the territory. You get to a feel for the organization. But if you open yourself up to those opportunities, it's a sort of amazing. You find yourself, especially at CI, you find yourself in places that you never anticipated.
Thank you for being here. My name is Ray, MBA student here. And I'm intrigued by the notion of what you said, open world vulnerability. So I guess, could you elaborate a little bit more on that notion and what can be done to deal with it?
Unlike places like China, where the government sort of controls what you can see, what you can read to a great extent, here you can read or look at whatever it is you want. You can, from the moment you wake up in the morning to the moment you go to sleep, you can look at only things you agree with, right? You never have to be challenged if you don't want to be. I think that creates that vulnerability because people can play into that. The counter to it, if you will, is the ability to think critically, to look at things and say, is that really true? I think in today's world, certainly here in the U.S. and maybe the Western world in general, it's let me see how fast I can scan through the headlines on my phone and then draw conclusions from those and I'm done. As opposed to, what does that really mean? And where did that actually come from? And I know it's tough and it's time consuming with a volume of stuff that comes at you on your phone every day. But I think the only way to get around it is this critical thinking, this ability to say, I'm not sure I understand that. The other part is to actively go and look at stuff you don't agree with. Because if you're only looking at things that you agree with, it's an echo chamber. And so you need to sort of see, what don't I agree with? Why don't I agree with that? I when I was an analyst, I was better when someone challenged me. I think we sort of need to recapture that ability to think about things in a more critical way than probably we have in the past.
Hello, thank you for being here. My name is Sari Kaufman, and I'm a senior in Yale College. And my question is, how do you see the war in Ukraine ending, and what role does the intelligence community play in fostering that end?
Well, that's an easy one, Michael.
It's a great question. I think to a significant degree, not determinative, but to a significant degree, Western aid is going to determine the outcome of this war. I think a significant decline over a period of time in that aid, which is a real possibility, would open the door to Russia winning the war, which can be defined as, driving Ukraine to the negotiating table and getting what you want, which is Ukraine not aligned with the West, which is a significant portion of Ukrainian territory belonging to Russia. Whereas if there was a increase in aid, a continuation of aid and even an increase in aid, it's not impossible to think that Ukraine could push Russia back significantly, maybe not take all the territory back, but push it back significantly to the point where that negotiation ends up very differently and ends up in Ukraine's favor. So I don't know how it ends. But I think how it ends is going to be determined much more in Washington, London, Berlin, Paris, than in Moscow and Kyiv.
I'll just elaborate for a second on that. If you took a look at and you saw what some of the captured Russian soldiers were saying, the three weapon systems they were most afraid of was Javelin, HIMARS, and ATACMS. U.S. systems that really hurt them badly. So without those systems, things would already be different. But it strikes me as this is a pay me now, pay me later situation. Right now, the cost, whatever it is small compared to the cost we would have to pay if you had a Russia right on the border of Western Europe, where we would have to send troops and resources, back into Europe that we haven't had there in a very long time. So this will pivot. And, Michael's point, this will be decided in Washington, London, Berlin, Paris is exactly right.
My greatest fear about our future and the United States and our democracy is the divisiveness that we're seeing now, which you mentioned you would have said something to the president today if you were in a... So my question is what you... I'm sure you're the CIA is thinking about this, or I'm not sure if you did it in your time, but what do analysts think of this? I mean, what is the cause of it, and how... What can we do about it?
Yeah, so we don't... CIA doesn't look at our own country, right? We don't assess our own country. But I've been out 10 years, and, you know, I think about it. And I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer to the question, what has, you know, brought this about. I certainly, you know, can point to individual things that have helped us get to where we are. But I don't have a, you know, deep analysis of why we're here, and I certainly don't have, you know, answers for what to do about it. I'm as deeply concerned as the questioner about where we are and where we're going. You know, I ran into a former Republican member of the House, very senior. I used to brief him regularly. He's no longer in politics. You know, I asked him whether I was going to see him back in politics anytime soon, and he laughed and he said, "Michael, this is not my politics, right? I couldn't get elected today." And then he went on to say, "And what I don't know is whether this period we're going through, this populism that we're going through." Is this a short-term thing? Is this 3 to 5 years, or is this a 25-year thing, right? Like we saw in the 19th century. And that was kind of a wake-up call for me, right? So it's a great question. I don't know the answer. I don't know anybody who really does know the answer. But it is the most important issue we're facing. It is more important than any national security issue, bar none.
Any thoughts on that, Andy?
Just that I don't know the answer. I certainly don't know the answer either, but it does present another attack surface for people who want to, you know, divide us further and do us harm.
Thank you. We had a related question submitted from students also about our polarization. So just to follow up, it's less about the domestic politics of our polarized politics, but more the implications of our intelligence community being wrapped into that, that there are, you know, people who might think that the agencies are involved in certain conspiracy theories or part of some sort of deep state that is trying to undermine our politics in some way. And so this is less a political question, but more about the role of intelligence leaders in trying to communicate the value, the bipartisan historic value that these agencies have, regardless of political party. You two are, you know, some of the most apolitical reasoned analysts that we know. And so I guess the question is, you know, what arguments are the right arguments to make in communicating the role of the intelligence community to an internal audience, a domestic audience?
So if people have the perception that the intelligence community has a domestic political agenda or even a policy agenda, it is much less likely that they will be listened to. They will be discounted. And that's why a perception of an apolitical organization that is simply calling balls and strikes with no political agenda, no policy agenda is so important, because your credibility of being unbiased is on the line. And if policymakers have that, then you're not going to be listened to in the sit room. If the public has that, then all of a sudden intelligence disclosures or strategic downgrades are going to carry a lot less weight. And people are going to question why you even need such an organization. So it's really important that perception be maintained and defended. I did get political for a period of time, right? And I think, you know, the consequence of that was it helped raise even more questions about the intelligence community. Because if Michael's being political now, was he political back then when he was running the agency, right? People have those questions. I think the last thing I'd say is to those people who think that there's a deep state, right? the deep state in the Trump administration that was failing to implement his policies were not career government officials. They were Trump appointees, right, at senior levels in these agencies and these departments. Those are the people that were not following, you know, what he wanted them to do. It wasn't, you know, a junior analyst at CIA.
Hi, my name is Alana. I am a former pediatrician, pediatric ER doctor who co-founded a child maltreatment center for three states. I'm here just finishing a degree in public health. And I promised my three children that once they were in college, I would leave the country and go into field work, which I wanted to do my whole life. My question for you is, as this non-biased, neutral group of the CIA that you were involved in, when you were briefing the president, just say in the context of, like, let's just say that you were there today and you were briefing the president on the situation of the children that were trapped in this war zone of Gaza, along with just informing the president, could you also point out the fact that in terms of, like, international armed conflict, how Israel is not, like, you know, not conforming to those and following those rules and principles? Or are you, as CIA agents, just burned down to the factual thing and can't bring in the law and the interpretation of the law? And I don't know, like, exactly what your backgrounds are, but I just finished a class in international humanitarian law here at the law school, and wow, it exploded my mind. As a person wanting to go into field work protecting children,
you know, one of the roles that the intelligence community plays in a situation like this is simply providing ground truth on what is happening, because it changes every day. So I'm you know, almost certain that there is a daily product that provides an update to the president on everything that's going on in Gaza. You know, the military situation, what the Israelis are doing, the humanitarian situation. In fact, no doubt about it in my mind, right? Every war that I've ever seen covered by the intelligence community has dealt with the humanitarian catastrophe that is attached to them. And I wouldn't be surprised, and it would be totally fair game for the intelligence community to assess how careful Israel is being or not with regard to civilian casualties. That is fair game for the CIA to judge.
Well, I hope everyone will tune into the Intelligence Matters podcast, which does a great service in bringing these national security issues to the forefront. Very grateful to Michael Morrell and Andy McCreadis for bringing the podcast for a discussion with all of you. So please do continue to tune in and join me in thanking our guests today at the Yale Jackson School.
I'm Andy McCreadis with my co-host, Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters. And you can always reach us at intelligencematterspod@gmail.com.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.